Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I hope you had a delightful 4th of July yesterday as we celebrated 236 years of the grand experiment in democracy that is our country. Since we're still in a 4th of July kind of mood, I've invited a guest who's a patriot. A patriot, of course, is someone who not only loves his or her country, but expends effort to make it better. Someone who believes in government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Not government by oligarchy or corporate control. So yes, my patriotic guest today is a participant in the Occupy movement. He's going to tell us some things you probably don't know about a study he's done on the relational analysis developed by another patriot, Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Let's start first, though, with that highly effective slogan the Occupy movement used. It was Colley Lassen's suggestion, "We are the 99%. It was a stunningly effective way to name what the media and politicians had until then paid only cursory attention to, the moving of money up to the wealthiest 1% in the United States over the past 30 years, or even the top 5%. So this was done, of course, first with President Reagan's big tax cuts for the upper brackets, and then another round with President George W. Bush's additional big tax cuts for the upper brackets. After those two moves blew a huge hole in the revenue stream for the public good, for governmental budgets, the squeeze was on for all the Americans who use public education, public libraries, fire and police protection, public health services, and aid for the elderly, the disabled, or the poor. I mean, I sometimes think the connection isn't clear between why there's such a huge student loan debt now. I mean, partly because President Bush allowed the banks to come in with that big profit layer, extra percentages, but also because the Reagan and the Bush tax cuts blew this big hole in the revenue stream, and public education started getting less support money, and tuitions went up. So who does that fall on? The people who are trying to use public education to enter society as educated contributors, but they're thwarted now with these huge debts hanging over them. And some people don't even enter because they know they can't handle that kind of huge debt. It's not practical. So besides the suffering caused by the forced cutback of essential public services, the very fact of significant income inequality has begun to damage our country, just as it damages every society where it's allowed to develop. I mean, there's been some mention of this, I grant, in the media and by the two major political parties, but it's not yet as widely understood as it needs to be. This hurts everyone in the country. And there have been many studies now showing that there's a strong correlation in all societies between income inequality and the prevalence of health problems, missed opportunities for education, depression, shortened life expectancy, infant mortality, criminality, mental illness, obesity, malnutrition, teenage pregnancy, illegal drug use, economic insecurity, personal indebtedness, and ongoing stress and anxiety. And that means anxiety for all levels, because, of course, they're the ones who are scraping to survive, to get by, and then the upper divisions who've cornered all the money tend to become anxious that people are going to get a little angry about this at some point. So these social problems are far more marked in the United States and Britain than they are in the European social democracies or in Japan. And There are two books that came out recently on this. I recommend both of them. The Spirit Level, Why Greater Equality Makes Society Stronger. That's by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And Peter Corning's The Fair Society. So here are just a couple more findings I want to share. Levels of social trust also reflect this relationship, whether there's income, general income, equality, or at least an opportunity society where smart people who are born without money can move up through a very good public education system from kindergarten through graduate school. The door is open for talented people to enter the professions. Those doors are being slammed now. They have for the past several years. So anyway, this additional correlation is about social trust. Levels of social trust also reflect this implication of whether there's income equality. In more equal countries, about two-thirds of the population trust others, while in the more unequal countries, fewer than one-fifth do. And within our country, social trust is high in the more equal states, such as Vermont, New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and North Dakota. But it's lowest in the most unequal states, the states with the most significant income inequality, such as New York and several southern states. Also, the children in the more unequal countries do less well on international tests in math and literacy. And the same is true with the children in the more unequal states when they take national tests. So this need to achieve greater social equality, I think, will remain a remote goal until a relational analysis is more widely recognized. And it's just painful to see that we're going in the direction of, oh, those examples that used to be in the textbooks way back when I was in school. And it would say, you know, several of the Latin American countries do not have a middle class or a very tiny one. And I would say, how can they not have a middle class? Don't they have middle class jobs like teachers and bookkeepers? And someone explained, yes, they have all those jobs, but they're paid very low wages. So everyone's struggling but the big landowners. And of course, we all thought at the time, oh my gosh, I'm glad our country's not like that. But we're well on the way. So I just want to say today, and 4th of July plus one, that we've done a lot right in our 236 years as a democracy. But we've also done a lot that was morally wrong. I mean, to start with, American society is built on stolen land. Every single house and building is on land stolen from the Native Americans. Our government made 400 treaties with the Native American nations and broke every one of them. And second, we allowed Africans to be forcibly brought here and enslaved for generations to enrich the landowners. And third, at the end of the 19th century, we advertised in Europe that the United States needed and welcomed workers for our fast-expanding industrial economy. But when those people got here, they found grueling conditions, sweatshops, slums, and heartache. It was only through the sacrifices and victories of the labor movement that we have a 40-hour work week, sick leave, and the absence of sweatshops. That's how our country became more fair, more just, and far less discriminatory. People fought for those large-scale corrections to horrendous wrongs. So to think that the United States is well on the way to going backwards now, to undercutting the economic stability of the middle class, and to making life for the working class and the working poor far more insecure, it's not only cruel and uncaring, it's also an affront to all those who gave so much in the past to achieve the structures of human decency that we have enjoyed. So I'm going to say it again, and not for the last time, the stakes are very high in the November election. try hard between now and early October to convince some unregistered voters to register to vote. Talk to any friends, family friends, coworkers, acquaintances, whom you think might not be registered, and explain why it is so important that they participate in this election. Well, back to the big picture. Here is the Declaration of Interdependence, written by the poet Gary Snyder. In this poem, he uses the term Turtle Island. That's a Native American name for this land, this continent. I pledge allegiance to the soil of Turtle Island and to all the beings who thereon dwell, one ecosystem in diversity under the sun, with joyful interpenetration for all. Mm-hmm. My guest today is Drew Dellinger. He holds a PhD in philosophy and religion and is a scholar of the work of Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. He's currently writing a book about King's relational worldview and analysis, and that book is tentatively entitled The Mountaintop Vision, Martin Luther King's Cosmology of Connection. Drew Dellinger is also an activist performance poet who has presented his poems at over 1,000 gatherings in this country and abroad. His poems, many of which are gathered in his award-winning book of poems, Love Letter to the Milky Way, have been cited in many periodicals and in venues ranging from prison workshops to climate change hearings in the U.S. Congress. He believes that there's much to be gained by linking ecology with social justice and both with cosmology through arts and education. Drew Dellinger has been called a deep and courageous poet by Alice Walker, and Cornel West has called him one of the most creative, courageous, and prophetic poets of his generation. Drew Dellinger, welcome to All Together Now.
All right. Thank you so much for having me, Charlene. I'm thrilled to be on such an intelligent, visionary show. I've been edified already.
Well, let's begin by hearing you recite the poem you wrote entitled Occupy Wall Street, which I happened to see when it was circulated around the Internet last fall.
All right. This poem begins with a few lines that I wrote in 2001 that I kind of use as an epigraph for this new poem in celebration of the Occupy Wall Street movement. So it's called Occupy Wall Street. We need global citizens for some sit-ins again. We need global citizens for some sit-ins again. I say we all meet on Wall Street and lock the whole block down. I take exception to the rule of the greedy and the cruel. This fall, school's in session and the lesson is Wall Street. It's time for action and your name's on the call sheet. It's time we all meet and name what it is. The game has been rigged to enrich corporate business interests that sent this economy spinning. Charlie Sheen is not the only clueless dude that thinks he's winning. See the 1% done spent all the rent. See the 1% done spent all the rent and now the rent's due. So we're coming to a tent near you. We're the like-minded 99% standing up to corruption with loving dissent. We're the like-minded 99% standing up to corruption with loving dissent. We stand for justice and the future and all of humanity, embracing all people. Yes, even Sean Hannity. The message is simple. Greed, injustice, and eco-destruction have to go. Pay attention, corporate media. We'll try to say it slow. It's time to rock the nation, rock this occupation. It's time to rock the nation, rock this occupation. It's time for the people to peacefully fight back. Tell Congress and the media we're taking the mic back. Tell the jaded it's that long-awaited revolution. Put away the pepper spray and reread the Constitution. These cops are paid to go crazy, yo. But we're peaceful. Don't tase me, bro. We came to incite insight. We came to incite insight. Unite and discuss this. We came to hang and to bang the drums of justice. Let's occupy with our love and our light. Let's occupy the earth and the sky and live with all beings as a planet-wide tribe. Occupy the divine mind residing inside. See, I'm the typewriter that's known to light fires and prone to inspire the moment's own higher desire. Because history knows it's the time for resisting the team at the scene of the crime. Tell your friends I'll meet them there at Freedom Square. Tell your friends I'll meet them there at Freedom Square. They can't stop us from Seattle to Chiapas. It's our mission to envision what comes after the catastrophe. How do we move past the capitalist disaster? Our communities need us. We are all leaders. How could we ask for anything less than the future?
Well, thank you so much, and I want to just insert here that there's a lot like that and more on your website. I usually wait till a little later in the program, but I know people are going to want to connect after hearing that. So check out drewdellinger.org. There's the text of poems, there are videos, and there's a CD and a book, the collection of poems. It's all on that website. Excuse me. Well, I'd like to start by hearing about the touchstone for all your work. Your sense of the interrelatedness of issues in ecology and social justice, as well as cosmology. Now, I and a lot of people who have been in the green movement since the 70s have tried to get that eco-social analysis and vision spread widely, with mixed success. So it's really edifying to me to see the younger generation coming to it from their own directions. So what does that linkage, or maybe you feel it's a proposed linkage, what does that mean to you?
Well, part of what I think it means is that our world is too interconnected to deal with these things in silos anymore. And I think a lot of this analysis has been built on the visionary work that was done by you and people like you in the 70s in the ecofeminist movement. I remember when I was starting to make some of these connections, there weren't as many people thinking about the linkages between ecology and social justice. I certainly remember you as one of those central figures. Matthew Fox was talking about these connections. Joanna Macy was making these links, and many others. But I think it's a recognition that our world is very interpenetrated, complex, and interconnected. And you know, we can see that in myriad ways. We can look at Hurricane Katrina, and we can say, is that a social justice issue or event, or is that an ecological issue? Of course, it's the combination of them. And so I think it's part of a radical or a systemic analysis, radical in the sense of going to the root and recognizing that minor reforms are not going to solve the social injustices or the ecological instabilities of the present. And so we need a radical analysis, and we need a systemic analysis. And so, you know, ecology and social justice, I think the issue of global warming and the climate crisis and the impact that made when Al Gore's film came out, again, this is building on decades of hard work by many different people around the planet. But I think that combination of recognizing that that these ecological issues and these social issues are interconnected is happening more and more, and it's something that we need to promote and to foster. And then where cosmology comes into this. Now, cosmology, of course, is an unfamiliar word for most people. Many of your listeners will probably be familiar with it, but it just means the story that a culture tells itself about how the world came to be and how we fit into it. So it's the kind of fundamental worldview that a culture has. Worldview is another good word for cosmology. So my mentors, Thomas Berry and Brian Swim and others, would talk about how all of our economics comes out of our fundamental sense or story of the universe. Our politics, our religion, all emerge from the fundamental understanding that a culture has about how the world came to be and how we fit into it. So now, when Thomas Berry was telling me about this 20 years ago, not nearly as many people were talking about the power of story as there are now. But I think that's part of one of the things we recognize. When we look at the economic issues and the financial inequalities that you were laying out at the start, and we look at the social injustices, the racism, the sexism, the patriarchy, the classism, the exploitation, the violence, we look at issues of war and peace, we see that one of the things flowing through all of these is that they're rooted in dysfunctional stories, in a dysfunctional sense of, you know, of the planet, of each other, of our connectedness, of our communities. You know, it's kind of a, when you were speaking earlier, I was thinking that this inequality is really a breakdown in community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, the stories that we tell ourselves, who do we consider to be part of our community? Who do we consider to be other? Who do we consider, you know, to be a real person? If we want to look at history and look at the ways that, you know, there were debates in Europe in the 16th century as to whether Native Americans had souls. Look at the ways that people of color and women and children have often not been granted their full personhood in moral, ethical, and legal senses. So I think there's a way in which the stories we tell ourselves about personhood, about community, about nature, about other species, all of these are interconnected with our ecological and our social crises. So it's not enough just to look at ecology and social justice, but we have to go even deeper and look at the cosmology, the worldview, the stories that are giving rise to these dysfunctional aspects of our society.
Well, I couldn't agree more with that last insight, especially about be aware of the stories that are framing the opposite way of looking at things. And all these right-wing think tanks who have, you know, employed all these very clever PR people are quite good at scaring people. That's what all these political ads are about that are going to have already started to flood the airwaves and will do so until November, especially in those swing states. But they're very skillful at just, you know, putting off the table everything you've been talking about and scaring people. You know, your grandchildren, your children and your grandchildren are going to be crushed by this federal debt. You know, in fact, we had a greater debt after World War II, and it was paid off when the economy took off. So they're definitely focused on framing stories. And I think more needs to be done, you know, to expose them. Because what they push off the table is, as you've just said, essential to life. And it's very important to try to reach people, especially this 40% of the electorate that identify as independents, with the fact that, no, you know, it's not a given that the federal debt's going to stay as big as it is. There was a big hole blown in the revenue stream when the tax code was changed to suit the upper bracket, so that could be fixed and put back the way it was when we had enough money to build highways and public universities and do what we needed to do. It's just so maddening. I know everyone feels this, who sees things this way, that people can be completely disconnected from seeing their own interests. What's really going to happen to their children and grandchildren as more and more of the burden for education, for paying for health coverage, for just being out there on your own is put onto the middle class and the working class. So, yeah, we need framing stories and stories that talk about, you know, what it really means to be thriving as humans. It means to be in community, having the sense of trust that we live in a fair society with opportunities and that we're situated in this larger community of the Earth community. And since you mentioned Thomas Berry, I just want to tell listeners who might not have heard last week's program that if they want to learn more about Thomas Berry, they could go to the archives at prn.fm, the name of this program, altogether now, and click on the program for last week about the Forum on Religion and Ecology. There's quite a bit there about Thomas Berry. Okay.
I've got one. I think what you're saying is so important, Shirley, and I just want to underscore what you said in terms of the conservative and the right-wing think tanks. I do think that there is a real narrative gap and a real funding gap. You know, these right-wing think tanks have been very well funded for 30, 40 years.
That's right.
And they've been very effective at getting their message out into the media and what we could call working the refs. I think the most effective meta narrative of the right-wing talking points is that the liberal media. that there is a liberal bias to the media and that the media is liberal. This kind of working the rest, they've kind of been very successful at convincing people that that's true, even though empirically we could look at media analysis and studies such as done by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and we could look at the number of conservatives versus progressives or liberals that are on the Sunday morning talk shows, and I think it's demonstrably false, but it's been very effective, this idea that there's a liberal media, and then the overcorrection or the hyper-awareness of the corporate media to kind of bend over backwards to placate conservatives, I think is a real issue. And I think one other thing I wanted to say about the power of story in politics that was really driven home for me, like I say, I was thinking about this in 1990 when Thomas Berry was first telling me about it, but I remember in 2004, James Carville, the political, you know, consultant, came on TV, and he was kind of doing a postmortem of the unsuccessful John Kerry campaign. Mm-hmm. And he said, the Republicans had a narrative, and the Democrats had a litany. And you're not going to beat a narrative with a litany. He was saying the Republicans had a coherent story, and the Democrats had a list. You know, here's what I'll do, or this and that. You know, it's like you're not going to beat a narrative with a list. And the narrative in 2004, as underscored by the Republican National Convention that year, was that terrorists are out to get you, and George W. Bush has the fortitude to keep you safe.
That's right.
Now, that's a pretty compelling narrative. Safety and security, of course, trumps just about everything else when you get to that level of human emotion. So I think that we need more insight into the power of narrative and the power of story and how to get this, and we need more funding for progressive narratives and progressive ideas and progressive memes, and we need to get these out in effective ways through the media and through the arts, et cetera.
Yeah, so all you donors and philanthropists, listen up there. I totally agree. I want to move into your work on Martin Luther King. I'm so interested in this. So when you started looking at the text of his speeches and some of his lesser-known writings with this perspective that you just talked about, of this interconnection, you saw some very interesting things. And what was that?
Well, let me just say, to defend my scholarly neutrality, not that it's been impugned, but I went in just wanting to find out what it was about the last years of Dr. King that I'd read several people, like Vincent Harding had said in his great book, Martin Luther King, The Inconvenient Hero, and Vincent Harding was an advisor to King and this sort of thing. And he said, we freeze Martin Luther King in our national memory in 1963 on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And we virtually ignore the last 5 years of his career, and as a result, we have a distorted, superficial, sentimentalized, popular image of Martin Luther King. So it was kind of reading Harding and reading Michael Eric Dyson and other people who were honing in on the fact that the radical years, the last 5 years of King's career, are very increasingly radical, very prophetic, fiery, challenging. He went through periods of depression. Anyway, so I started looking at King's work, saying, let me just discover, you know, let me go back to the primary sources. Let me read his writings, his speeches, his sermons, and let me see what's there. I'm hearing from these other scholars that there's a more radical version of King than we're generally aware of. So that's kind of what brought me into basically a 10 to 15 year project of really looking at King's writings and speeches and sermons. But as you say, I was bringing to it my interest in ecology and cosmology and having studied with Thomas Berry for 20 years. And so it was not hard for someone interested in cosmology and ecology to be struck by all of the cosmological references in King's work. I mean, he says the universe is on the side of justice. Mm-hmm. He says it. He mentions the cosmos of the universe in just, I mean, I could basically say every other speech. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got dozens and dozens of references where he says the universe is on the side of justice. He says we have cosmic companionship in the struggle for justice. Of course, he famously says the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, which is borrowed from a Unitarian minister. But And, you know, for example, one great anecdote is during the first 2 weeks of the student sit-in movement, which, of course, started on February 1st, 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. Well, King goes to Durham, North Carolina, and meets with some students who were participating in the sit-ins. And so, like, it's approximately, like, February 12th or something, and he meets with these students in Durham, and he says, "Know that all the stars in their course are supporting you, and that we have cosmic companionship when we stand up for justice." So it was pretty striking, the cosmological references. So then I kind of, delved deeper into it, and
now
I began
hold on.
From
right at that point, yeah. Hold on, we've got to pause here for the break. That's a good point. We'll come back to see when we went deeper, because I think a lot of the activists remember his last years when he did speak out against the Vietnam War and how that's been sort of overlooked, as Vincent Harding would say. But this, I think, has not been brought to the fore anywhere. So let's just pause here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Drew Dellinger, on All Together Now. Let's give them something to talk about, babe. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Drew Dellinger. His website is drewdellinger.org, and I want to direct your attention at that website to something you really should not miss. It's a videotape of an exchange that happened on stage. I happened to be in San Francisco for this event. It was November 2010 when Dr. Cornel West came to San Francisco to give a talk. It was an on-stage conversation between himself and Belvie Rooks, and it was sponsored by the California Institute of Integral Studies. So at one point, Drew Dellinger is invited to come on stage, and he gives this tribute to Cornel West. But in the middle of that is this really hilarious impersonation by Drew Dellinger of Cornel West that is spot on. I mean, he really has a great ear. And it's about the conversation that took place when they were both in jail, having just been arrested for protesting in front of the White House. So check that out. Go to drewdellinger.org, and it's under poetry, and then you'll see not only the list of texts of poems on the left, but a list of videos, and look for the tribute to Cornel West. Okay, let's start the second half here by, I'd like to ask you to recite the poem that's called Hieroglyphic Stairway.
Sure. Okay, here it is. Hieroglyphic Stairway. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I'm awake, because my great-great-grandchildren won't let me sleep. My great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, "What did you do while the planet was plundered? What did you do when the earth was unraveling? Surely you did something when the seasons started failing, as the mammals, reptiles, birds were all dying? Did you fill the streets with protest when democracy was stolen? What did you do once you knew?" I'm riding home on the Colma train. I've got the voice of the Milky Way in my dream. I have teams of scientists feeding me data daily and pleading I immediately turn it into poetry. I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech. I am the desirous earth, equidistant to the underworld and the flesh of the stars. I am everything already lost. The moment the universe turns transparent and all the light shoots through the cosmos, I use words to instigate silence. I'm a hieroglyphic stairway in a buried Mayan city, suddenly exposed by a hurricane, a satellite circling Earth, finding dinosaur bones in the Gobi Desert. I am telescopes that see back in time. I am the precession of the equinoxes, the magnetism of the spiraling sea. I'm riding home on the Colma train with the voice of the Milky Way in my dreams. I am myths where violets blossom from blood like dying and rising gods. I'm the boundary of time, soul encountering soul and tongues of fire. It's 3:23 in the morning, and I can't sleep, because my great-great-grandchildren ask me in dreams, what did you do while the earth was unraveling? I want just this consciousness reached by people in range of secret frequencies contained in my speech.
Thank you so much. Yeah, what did you do? Let's go back to what Martin Luther King did. And your book in progress is called The Mountaintop Vision. So can you tell us about why you're using that title?
Sure. Because King, of course, famously gave the speech the night before his assassination. It's called, I've been to the mountaintop.
That's
and
right.
At the climactic conclusion of that speech, he puts himself in the position of Moses, what we call in religious studies typology, which means that, you know, the same types of experiences that were experienced in the Bible are the same types of experiences that are happening now. So preachers often use this kind of typology to say that just as the Hebrews had to struggle for liberation out of Egypt, we are struggling for liberation here in America in the 20th century. So King is using a kind of typological frame, and he's saying, you know, he puts himself in the position of Moses, and he says, I don't know what'll happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promise. You know, and the crowd just goes crazy, because, of course, they get the full power of this identification. And he says, I may not get you there, they're with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will reach the promised land. And so I'm not worried tonight. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And the whole Mason Temple just explodes. He actually has to cut the speech a little short because of the intensity of the reaction. Hmm. But on a deeper, on a broader level, the mountaintop vision is my term for the interconnected view that King had in the last years of his life. And I think I wanted to call attention to what Vincent Harding and Michael Eric Dyson and other people were saying about how we tend to ignore the last years of King's life. So I coined this term the mountaintop period what I kind of call the King's mature vision and the ultimate kind of understanding that he came to. And so I define the mountaintop period as from 1966 when he moves to Chicago and begins expanding the concerns of the civil rights movement to look at economic justice. So to me, that moment in January of 1966 is symbolic of King opening the civil rights vision to a larger set of concerns. And so he speaks out really strongly against economic injustice starting in 1966. And then so I kind of see that as the year of Chicago and the North and issues of economic injustice. I see 1967 as the year, you know, of course this is somewhat simplistic, all of these are flowing over each other, but I see 67 as really the year of coming out against the war in Vietnam and the consequences of that. And I see the beginning of 1968. Of course, he only lived 4 months into 1968, but I see him both trying to launch the Poor People's Campaign, which is, again, a function of his interconnected thinking, and trying to broaden to envision and create an international expression of the movement. So on the last day, the very last hours of his life, actually, he tells his aide, Bernard Lafayette, he says, you know, Bernard, the next phase of the movement is to take it international. So I think it's very intriguing to think of what, might have happened had King not been prematurely taken from us. But I think the indications, the directions in which his thinking was leading are very clear. He was always trying to link issues. He was linking racism, war, and poverty. He saw peoples, nations, movements as connected. He saw the planet as connected. And when I really delved into it, I began to realize that he really had an ecological, or what we could maybe call a proto-ecological worldview, and where he saw all of existence as connected. He says on his great sermon that I really encourage people to read, called A Christmas Eve Sermon on Peace, he says it really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. This is the way our universe is structured. This is its interrelated quality. So putting all of these pieces together, I began to say, wow, King's vision is really a vision of connectedness. It's really a vision of interconnection. He's seeing the issues connected. He sees the people and movements. The planet is connected. And he sees all of reality as interconnected, interpenetrated. And so not only is there a cosmological dimension to King's thought that's been almost entirely overlooked, but there's an ecological or a systemic dimension of his thought that's been almost entirely overlooked. And then the last thing I say is I also looked back and saw that he did make some early environmental or ecological statements. He says, you know, it would be ludicrous for me to be concerned about civil rights and not be concerned about the survival of the world in which, you know, he said it'd be silly to be concerned about integration and not be concerned about the survival of the world in which to be integrated. Mm-hmm. He was mostly talking about nuclear war in these contexts, but and in another context he says it's very nice to drink milk at an integrated lunch counter, but not when there's strontium 90 in it. So he's talking about issues of war and nuclear war and nuclear fallout, but he also says the cities are gasping in polluted air and enduring contaminated water. So he clearly has, even in the most direct environmental or ecological sense, he has statements that we can clearly point to. Very few. I'm not trying to make a stronger case than is there. Very few, very limited. But he does have several quotations that I found where he directly addresses ecological concerns. But the larger point I'm making is that he has an ecological habit of mind. He has a worldview of connection and interconnection that I think we can appropriately characterize as ecological thinking or systemic thinking.
Yeah. It's a view I totally subscribe to, and all the new research that comes out is, you know, pointing to this relational nature of reality. So not only philosophically but factually, I think he was, you know, exactly right on that. But I'm old enough to remember at the time the blowback he got by mixing these big issue areas, not only from outside the movement, but from a lot of his colleagues inside the civil rights movement.
Right.
And it's the same kind of thing we heard when we were starting to organize the Green Party movement in the United States in the 1980s. I mean, well do I remember. You know, people were afraid their issue would get diluted if it went in under some big tent with other issues. And I think at a pragmatic political level, even though this ideal of this one, you know, great movement where all the people come together in a unified citizen movement, lately I've been thinking, what with the way things are now, this big block of 40% of the American voters identifying, self-identifying as independent, I wonder if it wouldn't be smarter to just have a big, massive citizen movement for a single issue, several single issue movements, because people left, right, and center could get on board. They might not be on the other issues, but you could get a big block of voters outside the parties, I think, by just doing this and hoping later people would see, you know, this everything we've accomplished now with these single issue movements is interrelated. But for instance, just one quick example, because we don't have a lot of time, but this issue of Social Security and, you know, all the right is doing to convince people that it's broke, and the only solution is to have young people work longer before they're allowed to get their benefits, and when they do get them, they'll get reduced benefits, and everybody's going to have to scrimp, and when, in fact, the problem with the revenue flow into the Social Security system, such as it is that we have a flat tax for Social Security, but it's not applied to the big income earners. People who earn over $110,000 a year do not pay any Social Security tax. They don't pay the same percentage we pay. We pay, if you're employed, it used to be 6.2%, now it's temporarily 4 point whatever, and your employer paid the other half. If you're self-employed, you were paying 13%. They're not paying that 13% on their income. So it's completely undemocratic, and if we would simply fix that and say everybody's going to pay the same flat tax on all their earned income, whether it's $1 million, $5 million, whatever, then, as AARP has said, 97% of the proposed shortfall is cleared away. So I think that would be a big issue everybody could get on board behind, but not if it's, you know, maybe attached to other things. Anyway, I just want to float that idea of how to be effective, because that is the hard lesson of politics. There's a difference between being philosophically correct and being effective, but I think he was deeply correct in all the insights that you have conveyed to us from Martin Luther King's writings.
Right. Yeah, I think there is. I think you bring up a very interesting dynamic, and I think one does need to balance. I mean, I think we need to have a worldview of connectedness and a narrative that links the issues and an analysis that links the issues. I do think trying to work or focus on every single issue at once is not a recipe for success. So, you know, I often kind of dream of what would it look like to bring all of the millions of people, the creatives or people that Paul Anderson has identified in some of his polling, and say, what would it take? I sometimes imagine like identifying 9 major points and then building a global movement that works on, focuses on one at a time for a 2-year period and then moves on to the next one or something like this. But I think that the Occupy Wall Street movement had a little bit of that potential in terms of focusing like a laser on the financial issue and the malfeasance of Wall Street, and I think it was at its narrative strongest when it was focused on occupying Wall Street and shining a light on the criminality of Wall Street.
Right.
And I have some sympathy for those who say, you know, we don't need to make any demands, and any demand is not enough, you know, but I also think there's something that could be done about putting some pinpoint focus on something like reinstating Glass-Steagall and ending the casino economy and the double dipping and the conflict of interest and this type of thing.
Hold on,
I think
here.
In some ways, yeah.
That's a great conversation to have, but I want to just use this last, we just have about a half a minute. Can you tell the listeners just where they might find out more? Your idea of this combination that you've come to, this using the power of dream, the power of story, the power of art, the power of action, how these feed each other. Can you just say a little bit about that and where they might find out more?
Sure. Well, I talk about these things, and I'm working on some writing, and you can certainly go to my website, drewdellinger.org. But I think it's just all of the – we spoke a little bit about the power of story, and I think Thomas Berry would say that, you know, story comes from an even deeper place, which is the primordial dreams, experiences of humanity. And Berry would also talk about reconnecting with the dream of the earth. So I think we need to connect back to the Gaian wisdom, and that can lead us to grow some new stories from that field of dreams, you know. And then the power of art is part of how we communicate these stories and how we motivate and inspire each other and ourselves. And then all of this is ultimately ineffective if we don't bring it into action. So we need to create structures of action. I think of the sit-in movement as a great example of a structure of action that people could plug into. As soon as that movement existed, tens of thousands of people plugged into that structure of action. So we need more things like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that brings us back to this quote on your website, one of your blogs, Martin Luther King's quote, when you develop a universal altruism, your loyalties are far beyond your tribe, your race, your class, your nation even. So being a planetary citizen with deep roots. We do have to end it there, and I want to thank you so much, Drew Dellinger, for coming on to the program.
Thank you, Charlene. It's been my pleasure.
Let's move over to the Arts Corner now. I usually read a poem here myself before I play a song or a piece of music, but today, since we have as our guest this great performance poet, I've asked him to deliver an encore. So specifically, I've requested one of my favorite poems, And this is Drew Dellinger reading a poem he wrote, Is She Radiant?, from his collection of poetry entitled Love Letter to the Cosmos.
Is she radiant? Is she radiant? She's the sun's little sister. Her skin, smoother than the lily in Georgia O'Keeffe's mind. Her lips curve around a word like justice. Damn. If I knew her better, I would tell her, you are goddess of the night sky, cloaked in humility, sweet as the knowledge of death. You are beautiful. Sacred involution, the divine folded into your thought, breath, emotions. For one instant to be one with her becoming, to be close to her unfolding, to be near her blossoming, for one instant to be one with her becoming. With seeds in her pocket, she travels through the city, the cycles of the moon in her womb, thoughts of freedom on her tongue. With seeds in her pocket, she travels through the city, her hair dark as the crow, black night. Is she radiant? She's the sun's little sister. Her skin, smoother than shadows and sweet like desire.
Thank you so much. Our song today on this 4th of July program is Sojourner's Battle Hymn, sung by the a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock from their CD, Still on the Journey.
Glory, glory, hallelujah. the prisoners went to join the slave army.
Sojourner's Battle Hymn, sung by Sweet Honey in the Rock. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please rate it at iTunes. Our theme song is Let's Give Him Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when we'll hear about the new planetary organization, the World Future Council. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.